Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, How Cocaine Happens. We'll spend this hour with Toby Muse, who was a foreign correspondent based in Colombia for more than 15 years. During that time, he met and interviewed coca farmers and pickers, observed the businesslike operations of small labs where the drug is processed, and spent time with both criminal bosses and assassins, and with the police and military officers trying to shut them down. We'll talk about how the historic peace deal between the Colombian government and the revolutionary group FARC actually destabilized Colombia and empowered cartels. And we'll talk about why it's so hard for those who get into the drug business to get out of it. Our conversation starts after a short break. The United States is the world's largest consumer of diamonds. Nearly 20 years after U.S. policy banned the import of so-called blood diamonds, gems mined in conflict zones and sold for the benefit of warlords, the World Diamond Council now reports up to 99% of diamonds sold anywhere in the world are mined legally. Our appetite for cocaine, on the other hand, shows little sign of abating. And as bad as the drug is for users, cocaine is even more dangerous for the people caught up in the business of producing and selling it. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Most of the illegal cocaine sold in the U.S. and Europe originates in Colombia. There are certainly people there who willingly get into the business. But ironically, the historic peace deal between the Colombian government and FARC rebels a few years ago created power vacuums that were quickly filled by cartel bosses. And in many areas, people have few choices other than the drug business. Toby Muse has seen this firsthand. He's an author, foreign correspondent, and documentary filmmaker who was based in Bogota for more than 15 years. His new book is called Kilo, Inside the Deadliest Cocaine Cartels from the Jungles to the Streets. Toby, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
You write, Colombia has always been too much for the Colombian government. What are the particular challenges to maintaining order and stability in a place like Colombia?
Essentially, Colombia is this tremendously beautiful but exceedingly treacherous terrain. If you see the topography of it, it's just made up of mountains, made up of these jungles. So it's always had this weak central government, and it's always been unable to exert control in the furthest corners of the country. Colombia has tremendous amounts, for instance, of the Amazon jungle. They have various other, the beginning of the Andean mountain range that go down to the rest of South America. So it's tremendously difficult to exert control. So what happens is you have this government in name in Bogota, but real power is in the local fiefdoms across the country. Sometimes it's exercised legally, but when you get out into the lawless corners of the country, such as where the cocaine is produced, often it's the narco militias, be they guerrillas or be they far-right death squads, that actually are in control. And that's been the history of Colombia for certainly the last 100 years.
So when the FARC and the government of Colombia hammered out that peace deal a few years ago, you were among those people who were really hopeful that the Colombian people might finally have a real shot at living in like a peaceful, functional society. Was there a plan at that time for filling the void that the FARC would leave behind in the regions it had once controlled?
Absolutely. It was implicit in this deal between the FARC, and let's just remember that the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, was at the time the world's longest running insurgency. It had started in 1964, if I'm not wrong. And when you think of the South American rebel, the South American jungle guerrilla, you're thinking of a FARC fighter. This was an organization that had men and women fighters on the front line, one of the few organizations on the planet to allow that. They all carried these AK-47s. They were in camouflage gears. They wore rubber boots because of the muddy environments they operated in. And they had been fighting. And these peace talks roughly dragged on for about 4 years. What had happened over the course of the Colombian Civil War, the course of the Colombian civil conflict, is that the FARC, coca, this bush that will be turned into cocaine, had become strategic. So you would see that the FARC would fight to control areas where coca was grown in order to finance its revolution. Or where the FARC held power, you would see more coca grown, and the FARC would take a percentage of that, of the sales of that coca from the coca farmer to the cartels. So basically, by the time these two sides sit down to have this conversation, much of the coca in Colombia is controlled by the FARC. It was absolutely implicit in that deal. The FARC was saying, we will lay down our weapons, we will hand over this territory, you, the Colombian state, must turn up and get to these faraway corners of the country and take over. And the FARC were desperate to do that because they knew that if the government didn't arrive, did not take over, the FARC's enemies would. And that's what we've seen happen, that the government simply dropped the ball and did not arrive to these faraway lawless lands, impose a minimum of law and order. New narco militias grew up and they've taken over. And that's why we have at the moment more cocaine than ever in history. Right now, we're living through the golden era of cocaine, much more than Pablo Escobar.
Was that a problem of a lack of government resources or a lack of will?
That's a tough one to know. It's because essentially the government, so you had the government of ex-president Juan Manuel Santos. He oversaw this historic peace process, and it became highly politicized in Colombia. This wasn't a peace process, say, like in South Africa, when you really got the sense that the majority of the country had come together for a new South Africa. This was much more highly politicized. There were many enemies of this peace process. Some, I think, were genuinely in good faith, that they said that the FARC needed to pay a much higher price for the actions they had carried out during the civil war, and they thought that the peace process was too lenient and they wanted tweaks to it. There were others who said that they were in favor of peace, but it's clear they weren't. They wanted the FARC destroyed militarily or to be absolutely embarrassed and humiliated into a surrender. So they were politicizing this peace process. And the government of Juan Manuel Santos, they signed the peace deal. The Colombian president won the Nobel Peace Prize, but then it just kind of dropped the ball. He had two more years for this, and a year and a half at least, sorry, I should say. And the resources just didn't seem to be there. There was the normal problems of corruption. Then a government was elected in, which was more hostile to this peace process. In name, they said that they supported it, but one of the leading intellectual godfathers of the government currently in power in Bogota had said before the election, we will take this peace process and tear it to pieces. These people, many of them do not support the peace process. So obviously with this government that's in power today, you've seen much more feet dragging. And just to give you an idea, we've now seen over 100 members of the FARC have been killed since that peace process. And this horrific massacre of social leaders and activists that goes on. Colombia now has probably the highest rate of the murder of social activists, land activists, human rights activists in the country, because these new groups are taking over the coca zones and they kill the activists as part of this takeover.
Okay, I want to understand why Colombia became the global epicenter for cocaine production. How much of that is about the unique topography and climate, and how much is attributable to the country's economy and governance?
Well, essentially, only three countries really have ever produced cocaine. So it's Bolivia, Peru, and Colombia. Colombia is the largest of them. And again, it's never had that strong central government. Colombia is also one of the most unequal countries on the planet. And it has a legacy, I think, more than Bolivia and Peru, of a history of political violence. This brutal civil war that I talked about with the FARC and the Colombian state. But there was also another actor, the far-right death squads. There's just been this legacy of political violence that continues to this day. Again, the FARC being assassinated, even though they've laid down their weapons, the social activists. So I think it has this kind of, there's a brutality to politics in Colombia, and the mafias have kind of grown up in this fertile territory of inequality and political violence.
I was sort of surprised to look. There's some photographs in your book, and the coca bush, I guess I didn't know what they looked like anyway. They don't look like anything special. How are the leaves harvested, and who does this work?
Indeed, that is kind of one of the ironies. Cocaine itself is full of irony. So this drug of glamour starts in the actual grim Colombian countryside, where it's just dirt poverty with this very plain looking bush. So the coca bush is grown by farmers. You go out to the zone and these farmers are quite welcoming to foreigners. These are very dangerous areas. And I do want to be very clear when we're talking about Colombia. Colombia has become a tourist destination for good reason. It's a stunningly beautiful country. If you fly to Bogota, if you fly to Medellin, you're not going to take a wrong turn and end up in a coca field. Mm-hmm. You now have to get to these zones. There's many military checkpoints you have to go through because these are basically war zones. These are in the forgotten, furthest corners of the country. So the place where I went to is called Catatumbo, which in the old indigenous language means the land of lightning. There's more lightning strikes there than anywhere else on the planet. It's up by the border with Venezuela. Here you have coca farmers who, again, are quite welcoming because they say, look, nothing else financially makes sense. There's no highways, there's no bridges. So if they're growing a ton of pineapples, how are they supposed to get that to market? And to give you an idea, again, how treacherous this terrain is, to get to this coca farm where all of these farmers were growing coca, from the largest major town, which is 15,000 people, it took 6 hours. 3 hours along a road, 3 hours down, an hour down dirt track, crossing over a ferry, another hour along a dirt track on a motorbike. When I looked at the map, that 6 hours was 30 kilometers. Imagine going that 6 hours with a ton of pineapples. It's going to cost you a fortune. So, but a coca you can reduce into a kilo of coca paste. Hmm. It's being grown by normal farmers. It's being picked often by Venezuelan immigrants. These are people who have given up hope in Venezuela with the massive mismanagement of that economy. And they've literally walked into Colombia just looking for jobs. When I was out in the coca field, there were 25 people picking coca leaves that day. It's like any other job out in the country. They could have been picking grapes, could have been picking strawberries. They were picking coca. It's very out in the open. They were all Venezuelan. And that's a job for many of these people.
I was interested to read that pretty much nobody in Colombia thinks of coca farmers or pickers as really being responsible for the country's problems with the drug trade. They sort of understand that many people have no choice but to do what these cartels tell them to do.
Exactly. And I think it's not even, I think it would go even beyond that. I mean, again, I'm speculating a little bit here, but I think people just understand how hard the Colombian countryside is. And so I think the majority of people, almost everybody, understands that the farmer is not really a criminal. I think the next stage up, people say, okay, you are in a criminal enterprise. But mainly people look at these people, technically it's against the law to be growing coca. But technically the only people who can are the indigenous. And I think that's an important part of this. The indigenous who believe that coca has spiritual qualities and they use it in their rituals. They can grow for personal use. But if you're non-indigenous, you cannot grow coca legally. But all the time out in the countryside, you'll see soldiers and police just walking past coca fields. They're not going to make a big deal out of it. Because if they started, where would they stop? But on the other hand, the police will launch major operations in order to eradicate all of the coca in a certain specified zone.
Yeah, I was fascinated to read about that. It is exceptionally dangerous work to be charged with removing the coca from a particular area. But in this case, it's not like the law enforcement goes in and takes control. They are literally racing against the clock so that they are not caught in the act of destroying coca fields by the cartels.
Indeed. And it's kind of two ways they approach it. One is that we went in on this lightning raid, that they just pick a coca field, they go in these Black Hawk helicopters, the anti-narcotics police jump out. And the police in Colombia, you have to understand, in the countryside, serve the role almost as a soldier. They look identical. They carry heavy weaponry. They jump out and they set up these perimeters and they destroy that coca field. They get back on the helicopter and they're out before the narco militias can kind of group up and launch a counterattack. The other way they do it is this manual eradication. And this is where you have hundreds of day laborers and police officers. There's normally two police officers for every day laborer. And it's a 3-month mission that they go into the jungle. And like a snail, they just kind of go slowly through the region of 3 months, setting up camp every 10 days and then ripping out all of the coca within, say, 3 kilometer radius of that camp. When all of the coca's gone, they get up and move camp. But it's this lonely life. Life in the jungle is extraordinarily weird. It's, you know, the guerrillas will tell you, I used to interview the FARC in their jungle camps. They would tell you there exists this thing called jungle time. It's a weird experience being in the jungle. You lose kind of all contact. You lose all points of reference. So these men, they're all men, in fact, they're out there. They're constantly feared that they're going to step on a landmine. These narco militias know which field is next. So they often litter these fields with landmines. Mm. So you see the day laborers and the police have these horrifically mutilating injuries if they're not killed outright.
My guest is foreign correspondent and documentary filmmaker Toby Muse. His new book is called Kilo, Inside the Deadliest Cocaine Cartels from the Jungles to the Streets. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with documentarian and foreign correspondent Toby Muse, who was based in Bogota, Colombia for more than 15 years and has written a book called Kilo, Inside the Deadliest Cocaine Cartels from the Jungles to the Streets. Toby, you say that one dark secret of the drug war in Latin America is how many drug lords start off as police and soldiers. How are they converted to the other side of the law? And how does that sort of insider knowledge of how interdiction works help them in trying to evade that?
Well, I mean, it just talks to the tremendous power of cocaine in order to be able to bribe these officials who are sent to destroy cocaine, often come back corrupted. There's so much money to be made in this business. So if you combine that with men and women who are not earning a great amount in these jobs as police officers, and then corruption can become a serious problem. And these people are highly desirable for the cocaine cartels because they know the inner tricks. So when it looks at places like airports, ports, if you can corrupt these people, then you can help to get these shipments of cocaine out. And I think that's unfortunately become very common to see. It's quite common to see in both in places like Mexico, Central America, Colombia, and across the rest of South America, these individuals who get caught up working with the cocaine cartels, because again, there's so much money to be made. And in Colombia, there's been a long tradition of police who have just turned and gone outright drug traffickers. One of the most famous ones in the past 20 years was one called Jabón, which in Spanish, in English is soap. He was a phenomenally bloodthirsty drug trafficker, and he started off as a police officer.
How does corruption work within Colombian law enforcement agencies? Are officers compromised by threat or by coercion?
This was fascinating. This was actually a policeman told me off the record, told me not to be cited, he said over a lunch. I assumed that they would pressure them, that they would threaten their family. And he said, no, it doesn't work that way. He said, basically, they'll get to you via a friend of a friend. That's the way it always happens, that a friend of a friend will come and kind of sit down and have a coffee with you when you're off duty. And when we're talking about something like, say, the airport, he said the job can be as easy as just simply looking away for 15 seconds. That's all you would have to do. That's all they're asking you to do. Just not be looking at the screen when one package goes by or one box. That's all you would have to do. And he said, I said, well, then surely you would be you would be under the thumb of the cartel for the rest. He said, no, it doesn't work that way, because if they tried to blackmail you, they would then get a bad reputation amongst the rest of the police, and the police would then combine to make them target number one. So he said, you know, policemen just will be corrupt for one operation, and then they'll go on with the rest of their lives. And again, the Colombians right now are going through a huge scandal about infiltration of the army. But throughout the history, whether it be the prosecutor's office, the police, the anti-narcotics police, the army, cocaine has so much money that it can afford to corrupt these people. And, you know, we should say that the Drug Enforcement Agency of the U.S. has had its own problems in recent years.
Let's talk for just a minute about La Gabarra. This is a place that you went. It's a small town that is basically the entire industry there is related to cocaine.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, to really get an idea of what these places are, I would urge people. I don't know if they saw that HBO show Deadwood, that kind of Wild West, Gold Rush kind of mentality. That's what La Gabarra feels like. And the industry there is coca. And, you know, I asked people there, they thought 80, 90% of the local economy revolved around coca, directly or indirectly. This is one of these coca towns. Essentially, what happens is the coca farmers they turn their coca leaves into something, a block, a brick of something called coca paste. Now, the coca paste is essentially useless. It needs one more process. It needs to undergo one more process to become pure cocaine. But that's what they take. They take that to these coca towns for market day, and then they sell it. They sell it on a weekend. And it's this just wild party. You go in there, you feel that electricity in the air of like money quickly changing hands. You can feel it. Cocaine has this weird, strange feeling. It's all tied up from the beginning with sex. And so in this town, you have the feeling of people making money, sex is on offer everywhere, but at the same time, anyone could step up to you and put a bullet in your head. That's what a life in cocaine feels like. And so these farmers come into town and they sell their coca paste to the cartels, who will then turn it into pure cocaine. They'll spend their money on whiskey, on rum, they'll go with prostitutes, and then they'll go back home to their mountain farm, to their jungle shack. At the end, they'll get on a boat, and you know, there's an old joke that they'll go home broke with, you know, a few pennies in their pocket and a sad story for their wives. That's a very common thing, but it's also, there's a sadder story behind there as well, because once a town devotes itself to coca, it really puts itself under the mercy of the coca, the narco militias. They take over. And it's kind of like a whole town decides to become outlaws. Well, then they can no longer rely on the rule of law. It becomes the narco militias that enforce their version of justice. And there's a social decay that sets in, because everyone becomes overtly individualistic. They kind of lose that communal good that they often worked for in the past. So you would see these towns in different parts that were dignified towns. They weren't rich, but they were dignified. They were getting by, whether it be by cattle or coffee. And then the infection would begin. One farmer 20 years ago would start growing coca. The others would see how rich, how quickly he became. Everyone would follow suit. Within a month, within a year or so, the dead bodies start appearing. There's always this golden age when the farmers think, oh, we cracked the code. We're not going to fall for the same fate as everyone else. We're just going to have good cocaine here. But no, they never win. And then you have, I mean, to just give you an idea of the money that can be made, prostitutes will charter airplanes to get into these jungle towns. They will turn the strip, the one road of these jungle towns, they will turn that into an airstrip. The plane will land, the prostitutes will get out. They know that they will make that money back so quickly. So you have these bizarre images of these urban prostitutes dressed in high heels on a break midday, going out for a Coca-Cola, for some donuts or whatever lunch, walking through these muddy tracks in the middle of these one horse town. It's a bizarre sight, but again, it just shows how much money can be made for these farmers.
You did that thing that I've only seen in movies, which is that you went into a brothel and paid your money for a woman's time so that you could interview her. Can you talk about that experience?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, and the question of paying is just the right thing to do. You know, it was, it was her time, and it was tricky, because in these towns, I stand out. You know, yeah. I'm from England, I'm white, I'm 6 foot. I stand out in these towns in the jungles of Colombia, in the mountains, in La Gara. I had to explain why I was here. I was there to write a book. I had to be very upfront. There could be no confusion about I was CIA, I was DEA. No, I was a journalist writing a book. And some people want to talk to you, some people will talk to you, but for a lot of people, just to talk can get them in trouble. And I spoke to this prostitute. She had come over from Venezuela, and this was her life. And she had come over with a group of friends. Like, most of her friends just couldn't hack it. They all needed money. They were in Venezuela. Again, I repeat, that's the epic mismanagement and the corruption of the Venezuelan economy. And now the sanctions have just plunged that economy into the ground. So these women came across. She had left her child behind. It was with her mother. She had told her mother she was going to be working in a restaurant. And there she was. And she was telling me about her life. And she said most of her friends couldn't handle the violence of La Gabara, because it's the narco militias are constantly fighting for control. So shootouts can just happen at any moment. The commanders of the narco militias will take girlfriends amongst the prostitutes. Once you become a girlfriend of a member of the narco militia, now you're in the war. You're no longer a civilian. So it was she seemed to be deeply traumatized by the whole experience. And she told me that she read the Bible every day after her work. And her work, I mean, I don't want to get too crude about this, but her work, a good day of work, a good day in air quotes, is she sleeps with 8 men. And it's this brutal experience to try and get some sort of money she can send back. And she would read the Bible, and she was convinced that this was it, the end times, that the apocalypse. And it was, you know, it felt like she was so young, and she was living in this grim, grim cell almost. I mean, this is all, she was over the age of consent. I want to be clear about this. This wasn't child prostitution, and she certainly wasn't forced to do it. But it seemed such a grim life for her. And I just thought, my God, the experiences this young woman has had. And no wonder she believes in the apocalypse. No wonder she believes this is the end of the world. But she told me she was going to move on. As we spoke over the course of this half hour, she said, "That's it. I'm not dealing with this anymore. I deserve a better life." And she said she was going to move out. She was going to move to the Colombian capital, Bogota. So I thought, good for her. And I really wish her luck.
Do you know if that happened?
I didn't. What happened was, again, these are the, there's a kind of, there's a saying in Colombia. What is it? Pueblo pequeño, infierno grande. Small town, big hell. So it's the idea of just the kind of gossiping. And as we shut the door, so that these brothels are arranged that there's a kind of main dance floor where people will dance and they'll drink. And brothels there in the countryside are, it's hard to explain that they're not run like a factory. They're run as these farmers will come in, they will dance, they'll share a bottle. And then after some time, then the couples will drift off into these rooms that line the main room. So I went into this room with this prostitute. We shut the door, but I could see behind, as she was shutting the door, there was a group of prostitutes sitting there all looking, and they kind of had an evil eye. And I thought, oh my God, they're going to start gossiping. And gossip in those types of small towns can get you killed. And to be honest, I didn't want to jeopardize her life by phoning her later on and a foreign number appearing on her phone in front of someone else, because that's exactly the type of thing people do who are working for the CIA, for the DEA. And there are multi-million-dollar bounties on some of the bigger drug traffickers. If you are speaking to someone with an American cell number, that isn't doing you any good in a coca zone.
So her trauma is understandable, and I think it's easy even to empathize with the predicament she's found herself in. You also write about a young assassin, someone who has killed many, many people. It's a little harder to empathize with him, but it does sound like he kills someone, gets enough drugs to forget about that enough to do the next murder.
This was a constant thing in my book. It was, where do I draw the line about my sympathies? Because again, a young prostitute, a young woman who's acting as a prostitute in order to feed her children, child, it's easy to be sympathetic. A coca farmer, you understand, someone who picks coca leaves. Then we start getting into people who were raised in difficult circumstances, but at some point you do need to draw the line and say, up to this point, I'll understand. And from then on, you're on your own. And one of them was this contract killer, Cachote. This is a man who kills for a living. He's the bodyguard of a drug trafficker in the city of Medellin. He grew up in a poor neighborhood. But this is where the Colombians, quite rightly, oh, what I like about Colombians is that they can be very direct about, hey, don't feel sorry for that person. They blame it on something called the easy money, the culture of easy money. They say this is a relic, a legacy of the beginning of the drug culture. So easy money culture is basically what it sounds like. Don't go to school, don't obey the rules, don't get a job. No, just, do this one quick job, and then you can earn as much as a man who, or w man and woman who goes out and works a regular job in a month, you can earn in an afternoon. And so he is in this life now as being a contract killer. He prays to the Virgin of the Assassins. It's astonishing. This shrine is there in Medellin. It's not difficult to find. It was the we believe it was paid for by Pablo Escobar for the assassins. They go and pray to this statue of the Virgin Mary before a job. And the idea is that they will be kept safe, or and their bullets will reach their target. And I would ask him, look, how can you believe in the Catholic teaching, so obviously in heaven and hell, and yet go out and kill for a living? And you get this, the thing is, people who spend too much time in the war on drugs are inevitably driven insane by this. Their minds just snap, and they're all half touched by madness. So he told me, well, if God didn't want me to kill that person, he would stop it. And if God doesn't stop it, and I actually am successful in killing this person, well, that means that that person was obviously had committed a sin, and I'm carrying out God's will. And so it's this complete evasion of any responsibility. And these sicarios, well, they never, the sicarios is the Spanish term for it, the contract killers, they never retire. They never reach retiring age. He'll be lucky if he reaches 30, 35. There is a time limit on those lives. So you see this kind of nihilism in cocaine, of life at 200 miles an hour, as much sex, as much drugs, as much partying as you can cram in, because you know the end is coming.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dealing with people who are so comfortable with bloodshed for, I guess, any kind of slight, and understand that there's almost impunity available to them, were there questions you avoided asking them because you didn't want information that could put your own life in danger?
Absolutely. It was a delicate dance carrying out these interviews, and I kind of felt like I was out by myself. I didn't know what other kind of journalist... kind of mythology. I hadn't seen it written down, how to navigate such delicate topics, because hanging around these people, the worst thing that could happen is that they coincidence happen and they blame me, because they trust me. Up to a point, I had been covering these people for years. I had been covering people at the absolute lowest rung of the cartel system, which would be the sicarios, the contract killers just starting out. And then I kind of, over the years, would interview more and more and more important people, until I got to interview a drug trafficker who runs his own crew. The worst thing that could happen is that they could tell me Monday something, oh, about this shipment going off, and then Thursday the police swoop in. They're going to think I was responsible for it. So I told them, do not tell me about upcoming operations. And especially, I can't know about people being killed. Just ethically, I can't be in that situation of someone has ordered someone else to be killed. So that was it. And there were some very close shaves for me. At one point, they told me some people were flying into the country, some Mexican drug traffickers were flying in, and they were arranging a party for them. They were going to do some business, and my heart sunk. I was like, this is exactly the type of thing I'm not supposed to hear about. Well, it's done now. The next morning I wake up and I see Mexican have been arrested at the airport flying into the country. And, you know, I spent the entire day fearing that my life was up. I thought, this is the kind of thing that they don't forgive. So this person who had helped me present me and introduce me to these various people in the underworld phoned me up at 9 o'clock, and he said, I'm outside, we need to speak. I grabbed a knife, because I know what they do to snitches. And I had this knife in my pocket, and I went down, and I wasn't going to let them take me to a warehouse. I wasn't going to let that happen. So I had it there, and luckily I got through it.
My guest is journalist Toby Muse. His book is Kilo, Inside the Deadliest Cocaine Cartels from the Jungles to the Streets. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is foreign correspondent and documentary filmmaker Toby Muse, whose new book is called Kilo, Inside the Deadliest Cocaine Cartels from the Jungles to the Streets. We hear from Richard in Austin, Texas. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I was just curious, what kind of a gap of, income might you experience, if the industry sort of went away? There has to be some... Does anyone have an appetite to actually do it? Right, it seems like people do, but maybe not.
Richard. Let me interrupt you. Yeah. Are you talking about finding something else for coca leaf farmers to grow or do for a living?
Yeah, the people, the mid level people, are the ones, I guess, that he was saying were kind of maybe not seen so highly, but the people below that, that kind of rely on that income, like what are they going to do?
Thank you for calling. What do you know about that, Toby?
Well, actually, it's a great question, because we know there's been various attempts to eradicate the coca leaf, right? And this is hundreds of thousands of people depend on this across the country. We know that there's various attempts, that there's been aerial fumigation where the police and the government have flown planes over just with herbicides, killing all of the crops. The other one is that the police will come in, as I mentioned, rip the crops out, all against the opposition of the farmers themselves. The other is that the government can sit down with these farmers and develop a plan. And this was part of that peace deal in 2016. 2 years, they would pay the farmer, as soon as they ripped out the coca, a stipend. The stipend, no one's getting rich. It's literally every month just to get by, feed your family. But there would be two one-off payments over that 24 months that would help them develop a new business. And the success rate was extraordinary. They would help that these farmers all agreed to do it. And basically, they were all agreeing. They would all just stick with this. Unfortunately, again, the government just lost interest. And the vast majority of farmers did not get all of the money that had been promised them. And now the new government has come in and essentially just given up on that program and wants to get back into the business of aerial fumigation, which is heavily supported by President Donald Trump as well.
You remind us that the Clinton administration created this multi-billion dollar program to pay the Colombian government to interrupt cocaine productions. What became of that?
That's right. And I think there's a kind of bookend of my experience in Colombia. We've essentially had 20 years of this military approach to cocaine, trying to militarily destroy cocaine. So when I first arrived to Colombia, it's in the year 2000, you had this Clinton-backed initiative, Plan Colombia, $7.5 billion. That was when that was a lot of money for these kind of these foreign policy objectives. Then George W. Bush came in, he embraced the policy as well. And it was this idea of transforming Colombia's police and military, arming them out with these helicopters, training them. The goal of that in the year 2000 was that within 5 years, they would cut coca crops by 50%. Fast forward 20 years. Now we're in 2020. There is more cocaine than ever before in history. The Colombian government has announced a new policy goal. By 2023, they want to cut coca crops by 50%. The drug war doesn't move forward or backward. It just constantly goes around in circles. And that was something the former president of Colombia, again, Juan Manuel Santos, that president who signed that peace deal, he described the drug war when he tried to get a global conversation started. He said, no one has suffered more than Colombia in the war on drugs. And he described the war on drugs as getting on an exercise bike. You pedal, you sweat, you get off after half an hour, you look, you haven't moved 1 millimeter. And that's what it feels like in Colombia.
I had never heard of narco subs before I picked up your book. Can you explain what those are?
The cocaine business is endlessly innovative. It's like capitalism just in front of your eyes. It's constantly adapting, constantly evolving. And they're always looking, these drug traffickers are always looking for new ways to get the cocaine out of Colombia. They're geniuses at this. And these are the narco subs. So these are basically almost submarines. Imagine the design of a submarine, but they're not 100% under the water. Most of them just have the pipes above the surface. The vast 99% is below the surface, but they have pipes to bring in oxygen and expel the exhaust. They can carry 8-9 tons of cocaine. They start at around $1.5 million. They're built in these swamp factories, these makeshift factories in the swamps, mainly on the Pacific coast. There they set sail for the biggest cocaine corridor on the planet, which is the Eastern Pacific. So imagine the western side of South America, Ecuador and Colombia, going up the underbelly of Central America and being dropped off at the border of Guatemala and Mexico. I was out with the U.S. Coast Guard for 2.5 weeks as we chased these kind of vessels across the Eastern Pacific.
Does the Coast Guard have any sense of how much they don't intercept?
They do. I think the Coast Guard estimates it between, I think it's between 10 and 25%. I think they estimate that they get. But again, it's all speculation. This is a world where no one really has the figures. No one really knows. They're just kind of filling in the blanks. They know that this, when I was out with them, though, they are taking down shipments of 3-4 tons of cocaine. And I actually start that chapter with 2 Coast Guard. And they're taking a break because they've been up all night. The Coast Guard cutter I was on was called the James, and its saying was, we own the night. So it was early in the morning, and these 2 Coast Guards are talking to each other. And one of them says, hey, I've got buddies on the force back home. You know, for them, it's a big deal when they get a kilo. And they start laughing because next to us is 3 tons of cocaine from an operation they had just done that night.
What happens to that? How is it destroyed once it's been intercepted by the Coast Guard or some other U.S. law enforcement agency?
Well, I understand that it's handed over to the DEA and is incinerated. Now, if there is, what they'll sometimes do is when they capture all of the people they're capturing, they're actually mainly Ecuadorian. And that was because I think the Colombian Navy at that moment had imposed a kind of blockade around a major port called Tumaco. They were checking every boat coming in. and out. But it's always whack-a-mole. So the Colombian Navy will put a big operation there around one port. Well, the traffickers just cross the border into Ecuador, pay some Ecuadorian fishermen, they take it out. If the Coast Guard is going to oversee, if the Ecuadorians will turn up and demand their people back in order to prosecute them in Ecuador, which occasionally happens, then the Coast Guard will give them a sample of, I think it's up to 10 kilos. I think that's the sample they give them. They just give them a tiny sample just in order for them to be able to prosecute. But mainly these Ecuadorian and Colombian fishermen are taken back to the US where they will face trial in America as traffickers. And again, when you talk about people at the absolute lowest rung, these are them. And everyone knows that. Again, you know, when I was with the Coast Guard, they had these two ideas in their mind and they're not contradictory. They said, you know we're only getting the lowest rungs, but we do have to get these people in order to build the bigger cases against the traffickers. But they were very conscious that really these fishermen that they were finding on the whole were not criminals. Yes, they were carrying out a criminal act without doubt. But these fishermen are often coming from parts of the coast where overfishing has made their job impossible. So they're often illiterate with little else they can do.
There are these massive smuggling operations taking place. There are also really small-scale efforts to get drugs across the border to an insatiable U.S. market for these drugs. You tell a pretty tragic story of a teenage American who got caught working as a drug mule, was really afraid to call his parents for help, and maybe didn't understand the implications of not doing so.
It was really sad. It was, he's an 18-year-old American, and it was at Bogota's airport. And this is an increasing dark side of tourism in Colombia. These foreigners are turning up, and they're increasingly becoming drug mules. And if you look, it's like a third of all of the drug mules, I think, in the Colombian prison system. A third of the drug mules captured at these airports are now foreigners. And so he had packed in... he had packed 4 kilos of cocaine. I mean, that's a lot for a drug mule. Average is when a drug mule is going to try and make a break for it, they're going to do like a kilo and a half. He had packed 4 kilos of cocaine into his suitcase. And he had packed it into these kind of squeezable bags that you would fill with mayonnaise or ketchup, if you can imagine those. Mm-hmm. And he had also littered his suitcase with other pieces of food like pasta. And it was obviously it was hugely suspicious, because wherever you're flying, why are you bringing pasta with you? It just doesn't make any sense. So, and it was this very sad image, because I could just imagine someone of confidence in this young man's who held in esteem and respect, just telling him, hey, don't worry. A, it's the lie they always tell drug mules. Hey, the fix is in. We paid off the police. When you're a drug mule, no one's paying off the police for you as a drug mule. They are paying off people when it's a multi-ton shipment. No one's paying off the police for 1 kilo of cocaine. That's not happened. So I could imagine that, or the other thing being saying, oh, well, look, you just tell them what supermarket you bought this in, and then they'll have to let you go. And he tries that in the interview. He says, oh, I'll tell you the supermarket. And the policeman is like, no, because no one sells cocaine in ketchup. That doesn't happen. So the policeman repeatedly says, look, you need to tell someone you're going to a Colombian prison. You need to find your family. The young man obviously can't face it. He just won't do it. Life in Colombian prisons is hellish. This is places where gangs and guerrillas and far-right death squads and cartels, they all run these prisons. And it's a hellish experience. And the policeman couldn't tell him that. You can see images out inside these prisons where they sleep in the toilets, but in shifts. Hmm. You don't even have a permanent spot next to a toilet. You just get 6 hours a day to sleep there. You have to make your own food. You have to pay for everything. And this young man just didn't understand what waited for him. For 4 kilos, I would say he probably got 5 or 6 years. I wasn't able to follow up on his case.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I was curious, how, Toby, do you fact check a book like this, which is full of such great stories, but it's not as if you can sort of call the parent organization and check up on what people have told you?
It's tremendously difficult. It's very, very difficult, especially in the underworld. I mean, what do you do with a man who says he's killed so many people he doesn't know? Because you ask around gently, but you can't keep asking these questions, because it just doesn't work that way. And if you keep asking questions, they're going to get very, very suspicious. At some point, you just kind of have to say, all right, enough people have told me that this man is a contract killer. I have to go with it. Enough people have told me that enough different independent people have told me this man is a drug trafficker. I have to go with it. It's very, very difficult to fact check these things. I went on the basis that, you know, when people, you kind of get a hint when people are trying to talk things up. And those are the people I found least interesting to speak to. I was interested by a commonality of these people's interviews of how regretful they were, that cocaine is the ultimate handshake with the devil, and that these people had all kind of enjoyed the good times, and now the wheel was going down for all of them. And they kind of, a lot of the people I spoke to, you could tell that they saw that the end, it might not be up front, but the end was in sight, and that they were regretful about their lives. And that went from the gang members in the slums of Medellin to the contract killer. It felt with a lot of people that the final chapter had begun, but the checking up of these stories is tremendously difficult. Colombia itself is a, there are certain places to operate as a journalist where it's very difficult. And I'll just give you an example. You know, you take something like the 9/11 attacks in New York, and that they went down to the they were able to confirm the exact number of people who died. That doesn't occur in Colombia. You have the largest massacres in the country's history that were carried out in the Civil War. No one's exactly sure how many people died. You'll see varying figures because there will be something that they counted it wrong, that someone who was listed at first as a victim of the massacre actually turned out that they turned up on the other side of the country, or perhaps families whose someone had died in an unrelated cause heard that there was money to be made. So they said, oh yes, my son died in that massacre. It's a country of experience and experiencing the sensations of it. It's not a country of hard data. I don't know if I'm really explaining it, but it can be tricky as a journalist to operate in that environment.
What kind of future do you imagine for Colombia?
Everybody unites on this, that Colombia cannot have peace if cocaine remains. It's just, it will not have peace. Colombia is such a country of potential, and it goes back to that initial feeling in 2016. I had never seen Colombians, especially in the countryside, the hardest hit parts of that country that had suffered the most of the Civil War. They were so optimistic, that ability to plan ahead. If you live in a whirlwind of violence, what are you planning? You're planning for next year? No, you may not even be there. You may have been forcibly displaced by more fighting. You can never plan. Peace allows you to plan a normal life ahead. And I saw people doing it, and it was beautiful. And it's so gut-wrenching to see the window slowly closing on that peace process. I don't even know if it's already shut. And right now we have so many different narco militias who have grown and been birthed in since that peace process. We're in a new chapter of bloodshed. But again, we painted on this. It's the world's demand for the drug that keeps the cocaine industry going.
Toby Muse is a foreign correspondent and documentary filmmaker. His new book is called Kilo, Inside the Deadliest Cocaine Cartels from the Jungles to the Streets. Toby, thank you very much for making time to speak with us today.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to the Think podcast free wherever you get your podcasts by searching for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.